Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Friday, the 12th of June, 13 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock. We're so glad you're with us this morning. We have a lot to talk about, and it's always better when you're here. I mean, you know, otherwise it sort of takes away the point if nobody's listening. But we know you're listening, and we know there's a lot of you out there, so we'll get together and hold hands figuratively and talk about what is going on and try to figure it out together. Maybe that will make a difference. I'm sure it will. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. That's how you get things off your chest and ask questions and make comments and let everybody know what's on your mind. Panel at WAMC.org. Oh, normally Alan would be with us. He has a previously scheduled appointment and is unable to make it today. So we wish him the best. I mean, it's fine. It's just a normal appointment. But we wish him the best, and we hope he has a great weekend. And so we have three wonderful panelists this morning. So let me introduce them to you all and tell you who we got here. Senior fellow and visiting professor at Bennington College, founder of Beyond Plastics, former EPA regional administrator, Judith Enck. Good morning, Judith. How are you?
I'm very happy to be with you. Thanks, Joe.
It's really a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much. Director, actor, educator, one of my favorite people in the world, Kristen Van Genhoven, co-founder and artistic director of Wham Theater. Good morning, Kristen. How are you?
Good morning. Wow, what a lovely introduction. Thank you.
Well, it's nice.
I feel the same.
Well, thank you. Very nice of you to say. We always love when you're here. We love when you're here. So thank you for taking the time out. And hey, we have a newbie today. We have somebody new joining our panel, and I couldn't be more thrilled. I will say that we have had Sienna on our docket since well before the pandemic, and then we thought, well, it's not really fair to have somebody on their first time, and then we thought, well, will we ever get back to the studio? So we wrote back and said, Sienna, how about now? So we're thrilled that she is with us. Sienna Freeman-Tolbert is an immigration attorney and associate with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna. She focuses her practice on all aspects of immigration law. Thank you very much for being with us. It's a great pleasure to have you here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. It's very nice, and I'm really thrilled. So give us a sense, before we get into the topics of the day, of where you're we talked about immigration law. I don't think I'm telling tales out of school to say that you were highly recommended by our dear friend Sarah Rogerson, who is a panel member who is currently on hiatus while she's running for school board. And as soon as she is done with that race, we'll come back. So we're thrilled about that. But given immigration law, give us a sense of your day-to-day work.
Oh, well, it's changing every day because every day our president's issuing proclamations for us. So right now, what we're trying to really watch is we're waiting and seeing if he's going to be restricting the foreign workers from coming in the U.S. So that's what we're really watching. We're monitoring individuals when they travel abroad, whether or not they're able to reenter the country due to COVID. So there are a lot of different aspects going on in immigration right now. It's very hot, and it's very day to day.
So, yeah, and it changes day to day, and a lot of cases in Albany, right? I mean, that's the thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have a lot of institutions here.
Am I correct on that?
Yes, you are correct. A lot of academic institutions in the Albany area that will be affected.
All right. I apologize. I have I had headphones, and then I changed out my headphones, and now I can't hear anybody, so I apologize. So I'm going to get that taken care of, and we'll be right with you, because it's weird for me to talk to everybody if I can't hear you all. So I apologize for that. Let me just take the end part of that.
You mean you can't solve that problem, too? I mean, WAMC has done such a great job with all of us phoning in remotely.
There we go.
We could give it a try.
All right. There you go. It's all good. I once again have voices in my head, so that's good. We're all set. I apologize. thank you. Completely my fault. But so there's like two different jacks, and we had a quick headphone change, and but the jack was different, so when I put it in, it didn't fit, so we had to get the other jack back. So I didn't hear you. I heard most of what you said, Sienna, so I welcome you. I thank you very much for being with us, and it's just a great pleasure to have you join our ranks. Let me get on to what is happening in the world. And yeah, you can't do the show with Avin without having a lot of voices. And Mike Bowen, who is our wonderful board op, you know, has to tell me what to do. And so without that, I'm pretty much lost. Let us talk about Confederate statues, and we'll talk about statues in general. I mean, we even have the story out of Albany about Philip Schuyler and that statue being taken down as well. The mayor of Albany making that executive action yesterday, announcing that. 150 years after the end of the Civil War, the sculpture of Jefferson Davis, president of the Confederacy, was toppled in the Virginia city that American secessionists called their capital. In Alabama, a statue of Robert E. Lee, the Confederacy's most honored general, was knocked over in front of a Montgomery high school that bears his name. In a blitz that burst out of the anti-police brutality movement, protesters this month have vandalized and removed dozens of monuments to Confederate politicians and soldiers across the South, from Virginia, where the Democratic governor embraced the removal of symbols that many whites once considered sacred, to Alabama, where Republican lawmakers recently made it illegal to relocate or remove any Confederate memorials. Dramatic scenes of destruction recalled the fall of the Soviet Union when crowds tore down statues of Lenin, Stalin, and other icons of totalitarianism. This eternal conflict, born in slavery and kept alive through a century and a half of battles over race, civil rights, and American identity, has flared once more, focusing yet again on the symbols of the bloodiest war ever fought on U.S. soil, a war between brothers. So, Sienna, let us begin with you, of what you make of this and this point in time where we are once again, but certainly more loudly, having this conversation.
I mean, I'm excited about it. I can tell you personally that I see, you know, symbols, the Confederate flag, Confederate statues, as microaggressions. It's a reminder to me of the past, my past history of slavery, right? And when I see a Confederate flag, I feel fear. If I see someone driving with a Confederate flag on the back of their car, it's scary for me.
Yes.
Because to me, it says to me that that person considers me may consider me property. And that might not be their intent, but that's what that shows to us as Black Americans, that you're driving around holding up a flag where they were fighting for African Americans to remain property. That's what it means. And so I think a lot of people forget that. I think it is important to keep in history. It should be a museum. You should tell the story. I don't think the story needs to stop being told. But to have it held up in esteem is sad this day and age.
You know, one of the things I keep on hearing from people is that, look, I go by that statue every day. It doesn't mean anything to me. It's, you know, it's a statue. Who cares? But the fact that we don't care, or that we don't notice and we don't know that history, is exactly what you're talking about. That's the concerning part, that it just becomes accepted.
Exactly. Exactly.
Judith, go ahead, Sienna. No, go ahead.
I mean, I lived down south in Georgia for a while, I just want to say, and to think about now, I have two little kids, and to have to celebrate Robert E. Lee's, a special day for him, and try to explain to my children why he's special, that's just a hard conversation to have.
Right.
So I just think I'm really excited and really happy that we're making these steps.
And we're
make
here.
Everyone in the country feel equal and accepted.
And we're hearing this from Black soldiers as well, who are going to these various military bases that are named for Confederate generals, and they're saying, look, I'm giving my life to the country, but it makes me feel uncomfortable that this is where I'm doing this. I have to explain that to myself. You know, who knows where that particular fight is going to lead, but it is yet another one. Judith Enk.
Well, that was so beautifully said. It's hard to supplement other than to say this is long overdue. And I think it's very healthy to talk about why these symbols, statues, flags need to come down ASAP. And then wouldn't it be delightful to have an open, you know, spirited discussion about what the replacement should be? Virtually all of these statues in cities and public places are of white guys, whether it's people associated with the Confederacy or slave owners in the case of Albany. But wouldn't it be nice to see different faces celebrated? And I think it could be a very educational, interesting community event to talk about who to put up in replace. And there's so much history that is not taught in schools. You know, right. let's elevate those voices and involve students. So, you know, kudos to Mayor Kathy Sheehan for doing that, and let's hope others in the region follow. I might add, you know, you've got military leaders supporting stripping the names of Confederate leaders off of military bases. You've got NASCAR, you know, that left-wing operation, finally dealing with the flag. I mean, the real outlier here is, of course, Mr. Obvious, the president. So let him stand alone and let the rest of us move forward with some responsible decision making here.
I have a follow-up question to that, but I want to get to Kristen's thoughts first. Kristen.
Well, first, welcome, Sienna. So nice to have you. Now I'm no longer the newbie, which feels so great.
Oh, God, you're a senior principal at this point. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. It's so awesome. Yeah. You know, there's two things. I'll follow up. I love the idea of, you know, Sienna talked about, like, keep it in a museum and in context. And we're seeing museums all over the, well, country and North America and the world using this as an opportunity to tell history as it actually was, right? So they're not just going to show the really nice tea set. They're also going to show the evidence that house had slaves. And this is another opportunity to take these statues. I can't say I have the optimism that that's going to happen, but it does seem like a really an opportunity to actually rewrite history in the way that it should have been told originally. So that's an exciting idea. I'd be curious to see if anybody's going to end up doing that, if any museum will step up to that opportunity. The other thing, of course, is I always observe these things as a Canadian and as a feminist, right? And so to me, every statue should be taken down. Because, you know, I mean, in the stats at the moment are so overwhelmingly, like over 90% of statues mm-hmm. in the U.S., depict male figures, right? And mm-hmm. 7.6 are female, and there's probably zero non-binary statues. So there's obviously a huge amount of work that has to be done around that too. So I can't say that I'm sad they're coming down. I was really struck in the article about, you know, that they chose to share this quote from this historian for the sons of Confederate veterans about not being able to satisfy some people. And it's, you know, the only way we can come together is with tolerance. And it shows us really how far we still have to go, that there are people who still believe that this is not about tolerance, that this is not about, and at this point, the people we're not going to satisfy are the people who are still supportive of a white supremacist culture. And hopefully what we're seeing is that percentage is getting lower and lower and lower, which is long overdue, as Judith said.
We just have about 2 or 3 minutes before the break. And the follow-up question I wanted to ask, and Sienna, I'll begin with you. But when you talk about, and I asked the question because we got letters on this yesterday of this was before Mayor Sheehan made the decision to take the Schuyler statue down. But we got several letters that said, okay, but if you start down this slope of Americans who held slaves, you are going to, you know, you're going to change your money, you're going to change you're going to change your statues, you're going to change the very foundation. So I am wondering about your thoughts about that. And yes, is that such a bad thing?
It's not. Change the foundation. That's the whole problem. It's systematic. I think it needs I agree. Let the statues come down. And put something up more uplifting, something you and your family can go take a picture next to and be proud of, and you can explain to your kids what it stands for. I think that's more important. It can be, like I keep saying, put it in the history books,
right.
Teach it in the class, in context. But no, that's the problem in the U.S. is our foundation is based on slavery, and we have to get it at the roots.
Judith?
Well, I think the all-female panel agrees, and it's shocking, right? This is not.
Thank you for making me an honor. Like, can you make me an honorary feminist at least today?
You are an honorary woman, Joe.
Thank you.
Very few have that distinction, but you earn it. This is not a side issue. This is fundamental. This is who you hold up in society to get one of those, those brick statues or stone statues is important. And maybe you don't notice it every single day, but the first time, the second time you go by, you do. And I love the point of you want to be proud standing next to the statue. You know, I have a great photo of my mother and I next to an Eleanor Roosevelt statue at the Roosevelt Memorial in Washington, D.C. More of that.
Yes, agreed. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have a lot of letters on this, so I'll go to those as well, and we have much more to discuss. We have Judith Eng, Kristen Van Genhoven, and Sienna Freeman-Tolbert with us. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Listening to the Molly Miller Trio this morning, the album The Shabby Road Recordings. We have our playlist of all the music that we play during the panel online, WAMC.org/roundtable. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. I will get to them in just a moment. We welcome Judith Eng, Kristen Van Genhoven, and Sienna Freeman-Tolbert. They are making up our panel this morning. Let's go to some of the letters. They're kind of all over the place, and I love that, so let's go. Joe says, is there another country that celebrates the flag and leaders of the losing army of a civil war? First, they were traitors. Then they were losers. Dear panel, says Amanda, I am one of Skyler's fifth great-granddaughters. He profited enormously from the abuse and toil of enslaved human beings. His statue and veneration in Albany needs to go. That's an interesting perspective.
Good for her.
Yeah, when your family turns on you, you know it's done. which, you know, at some point I think we've all experienced. Jonathan says, considering the monuments and statues, should we take down the Washington Monument and the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C.? As far as rewriting history, was this not one of our criticisms of the Soviet Union? Sienna?
Touche. I was thinking about that. I don't think in D.C., which is a historic, you know, I went to school there, and I think D.C. serves as more of a museum in and of itself, walking around, seeing all the presidential monuments, going to the various museums there. I think it served a historic purpose being there.
That's a good point.
My opinion, versus having a random statue of a slaveholder in front of a town hall. It's out of context. I think it's more in context in D.C. It makes more sense there, where you can go to the various museums, or you read about, you have your plaque there, but you go into the museum and learn more about what this president did. So I think it's a better context in D.C. than it is randomly placed throughout the country.
We got this.
In my opinion.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point about D.C. because it is a museum in and of itself, isn't it? Anybody else on that, Judith?
Well, if there's an effort to rename cities and airports, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. City, I'm for that.
yeah.
You know, you print up some new stationery, a new zip code. I think these are, you know, to use the overused phrase, these are teachable moments. You know, this is a moment we're going to remember for the rest of our lives. And if we can, you know, it's the little things that add up. And I don't think this is necessarily a little thing, but I think there should be an examination of, you know, not just statues, but, you know, bridges, airports, schools. Let's think about this. What are the values we are portraying as society? Who made the naming decisions early on? Now, what I fear is, you know, we don't want this to become commercialized. You
right.
know how our arenas are now named after
Nike Town.
Right, exactly. This could go off the rails.
Well,
you know, it's interesting. When I heard the letter, I had like an emotional response, like, you know, oh, but that the monument is so beautiful. On the other hand, like, I don't, you know, I just was like, oh, what is the history of the Washington Monument? And it's built to commemorate George Washington. And so you're like, oh, ooh, that doesn't feel good now, right? So the letter writer makes a really good point, and in like we're all saying, what's the context? How do we rethink all of these things, you know, and examine the values behind it all, examine our feelings around it? You know, why did I have that emotional reaction, which isn't based on anything other than like, you know, it's a beautiful statue or any sort of memories I might have of it, but. Yes, the letter writer in many ways is right.
You know, yes.
Yes.
Yesterday, the tone of the letters was very much that there was a distinction being made between the Confederate generals and those of our founding fathers. And the distinction being made was, okay, first of all, the Confederate generals were, as one of our letter writers wrote just this morning, were traitors and losers. Also, and that's different than someone who, yes, was a slaveholder, but also created the nation that we live in, warts and all. So I asked the question of, does it? This is to your point, Kristen. I agree with you, and I don't know. I don't really know how I feel completely about, you know, the Jefferson Memorial or the Washington Monument, other than to say I grew up in, I was born in Washington, D.C. I love that city very much. I can't imagine that city without those things. But isn't it part of, isn't it our job then, even if you, especially if you keep them up, which I think is where I'm leaning, that you offer the context?
Yeah, you bring up something that is complex and simple at the same time, and it's.
Oh,
it's
I'm known for that.
you know, it's very challenging. All of us are being asked to question every part of who we are, why we are the way we are, what has formed the way we are. And that's a deeply uncomfortable process. There are no easy answers. You know, changing the foundation, it is not it's not about breaking everything. I mean, in some ways, it is very much about breaking everything down and starting from scratch. The first step, which for it seems for many people is happening now, is our eyes being awakened to how many of these microaggressions, to Sienna's point, are around us constantly, built into the very fabric of this country. And that's a deeply uncomfortable fact to face. So we do need to allow ourselves the time to grieve that we're, you know, many people are waking up to that. What does that mean? We're going to resist the urge to look at the founding fathers, which is, you know, yes, that says it all, right? Founding fathers. But to your point, if George Washington was a slave owner, like, period, done.
Right.
You know, that's the simplicity and the complexity. Founded the country, was a slave owner. What do we do with that as America? That's the question we're all facing, which is simple and complex.
Sienna? Okay, I'm sorry.
I think.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Sienna.
Oh, what I was going to say is it's about education, right? I think of the founding fathers for, you know, what they did in essence, but also tell me about the person. And that's
right.
The problem with our educational system is, yes, I get it. As a kindergartner, you can say George Washington is the first president. But as the kids get higher and higher up in levels, they need to understand what George Washington as a whole, his flaws and all. I think about, not to be cliche, but Hamilton, right? He did
right.
great things. But he was a flawed individual. And that's the stories we shouldn't be afraid to educate our kids about and our high schoolers about. And that way, when they stand in front of the Washington Monument, their teacher has already informed them of his flaws. So you know about the whole person. And I think that's the problem. It goes back to education. We weren't educated about George Washington's flaws, Thomas Jefferson's flaws.
Right.
That's what we need to know.
Right.
And then we can look at the monument a little bit different. I think that's the difference. Instead of getting, you know, for lack of a better word, whitewashed history, where they were just great people.
Right.
You know, they were complex people, like everybody else.
Like everybody else. And it is important to have that and to have that context. You know, I know this is taking the discussion. I don't mean to take this off into a different direction, but I know this often comes up in presidential museums, which I have. I collect experiences of going to all of our presidential libraries and museums. And it's interesting because it's how do you present yourself, but also present yourself in context. And I've been really, really moved and interested in how the libraries have been able to say, this is a really, I mean, even like the Nixon Library, like this was really bad, you know? Put it into a context. You know, this is what happened, and this is the tape, and this is what happened. What president doesn't have something that they probably regret or that we will look at and wince at? But we can do it. It's just having the will to do it, right? Judith?
Absolutely. And I'm so fearful of what the Trump presidential, you know, the one term Trump presidential library is going to look like. Just putting that out there.
Well, I think we know what it's going to look like.
A casino?
I think it's going to be big, gold, and garish, I think is what it's going to look like. Just a couple of letters before we go to a break. Anthony says, we need to teach that historical figures were complicated, imperfect people, products of their time, and not treat them like gods. My guess is that a significant portion of Albany's 100,000 residents didn't know who the man was and can't even get to the statue's plaque without the risk of getting hit by a car. I will attest to the second part of that statement. Yes, that is true. Good luck parking down there. But good point. Let's see. General Schuyler helped win the Revolutionary War so we would all have freedom. Not saying taking down statues is right or wrong, but he helped win the Revolutionary War, says Sean. How in the world can someone be proud of Christopher Columbus after learning about the way he decimated the lives of men, women, and children during his forays into the Caribbean? Change Columbus Day, Columbus Circle, Columbus Avenue, etc. Totally appropriate. The governor of New York State spoke out about that yesterday, was not in favor of taking down the statue in Columbus Circle. Judith, what do you make of that?
Yeah, that's a problem. you know, it's. I think it's something that many Italian Americans that are proud of their heritage seem to have a little bit of a blind spot. Bring the letters on. I'm expecting them. There are some major problems with Columbus, and he is celebrated and has a holiday, and it's
which there's
it's
a whole
all, it's
There's a whole movement for Indigenous Peoples Day as opposed to Columbus Day.
I tend to always make sure I work on Columbus Day. That's my personal little protest. But how is that different than any other day? But I do take MLK Day off. You know, we all kind of make our personal statements, but this is about, you know, public narrative. So I think that will be discussed and debated for some time.
We have a lot more letters, and I do want to move on to other subjects. A lot of big stuff happening, so I want to get to that as well. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your input, panel at WAMC.org. Here's a letter from Jim who says, consider this, unlike the past, there have been no organized counter-protests to statue removal or anti-racism protest or Confederate flag removal. I see that as white offerings to calm the masses, but letting blacks vote, now that is going too far. Nothing will bring about change like voting will. Focusing on statues, flags, and protests will accomplish little unless people go out and vote. Sienna?
I agree. I mean, I agree that voting is important, but I also think it's also as important for us to be able to live in an equal society where that's free of microaggressions. So voting is the most important. I would never say that it's not. Everyone should get out and vote and express their right. We fought for that right. But to say that the statues is just, you know, something ancillary, it's not the truth. We drive past it every day. We have to look at it every day. And we need to ask ourselves, why is it there?
George writes and says, Confederate flags represent treason, as do the monuments. There are the banners of military forces who killed thousands of Americans and statues of people who led them into battle against our country. We don't have statues of Ho Chi Minh or Pol Pot. Those are history, too. This is a cultural question, Kristen, but in Canada, what are your statues like?
And I don't know the answer to that. I'd have to look it up. I can't imagine they're that different in terms of gender breakdown. I would like to say that there are more statues recognizing the Indigenous people of Canada, the Inuit. I don't know that that's true, so that's something I'll have to look into and get back to you.
I didn't mean for you to have to do homework. I was just wondering, like, what your high school field or your grade school field trips were like. I mean, again, I grew up in the D.C., Philadelphia area, so we spent a lot of time with the Founding Fathers, but I don't know.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, no, I definitely spent more time learning about the Indigenous culture, where Canada was started, but I grew up in a rural community, so different than where you were in the urban world, you know. But just like here, I think many of us go about our day to day with a lack of curiosity about the things that we're driving past. And I am at, you know, that's how do you change that? Because that means that we're constantly driving past things that are sending messages that don't align with our values as citizens and humans.
Dave writes to us and says, history is messy. There are major problems with all of history because the books are written by the victors. It will be better to clarify and contextualize these monuments, recognizing that in different times, different things were acceptable. The Confederacy was different only in that we allowed the losing side to tell their stories as they saw fit. The reason is more because the winning side was not wholly against what the Confederate monument stood for. That from Dave. We go to Glenn, who says, if you visit Germany, you won't see any Nazi symbols or icons in the streets, but you will see them on full display in museums. If you visit a museum, you feel as though Germany has accepted its past but has chosen to move forward. Robert says, we must be careful when judging past generations by today's standards. Can we be sure that future generations will not condemn us for everyday habits such as eating animals raised on factory farms? Oh, that's a really good question.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's a really good question. Yeah, I think about this a lot in terms of, you know, in 50 years or 100 years, are they going to look back on this time as the time where the foundation's changing? Like, has it been changing for, you know, the past 40 years, 50 years? That's a very interesting question. And yeah.
I mean, they're making eating animals, but Judith, I would think even, you know, their environmental history, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, in 40 or 50 years and sooner, people are going to look back and they're going to be very upset with us for not dealing with climate change. And you know, lots of environmental matters. But I think we also, you know, putting this in context, look at the Me Too movement. Are we, you know, today going to see statues of Epstein and Harvey,
Jeffrey Epstein and Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah. I'm happy to forget part of their names. 50 years ago, Hollywood, you know, that's the way showbiz works, Missy. Me Too movement. These guys are in jail. So, you know, we can inject some common sense here. I think not celebrating Confederate leaders is quite reasonable in 2020.
Jeff sends an interesting letter and says, last fall I went to the Schuyler Mansion and I was very surprised by two things. The National Park Service had a new initiative to teach about slavery where their site was related to it. This surprised, considering our current president. I said slavery was illegal, outlawed in 1799, they informed, no, there were many loopholes, so that there was slavery in some cases to the mid-1800s. The abolishment of slavery in New York was gradual and spotty and did not end on one date. So that is a testament to what we were talking about, of putting it into an historical context. Andre says, the foundation of this nation was built on the wholesale slaughter, genocide, and slavery of the American Indian population. How does this fit into this narrative of the rethinking we are engaged in? Well, to the Columbus statue, I think it does fit in, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think exactly. Columbus, and then also, what's that team? Isn't there an NFL
Redskins.
Team?
Redskins.
Yeah, we still have. I was thinking that as well. Exactly.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up earlier. Yeah, we have a team in the NFL of the Redskins. We also have the Chiefs. We have the Braves. We have the where the names aren't as disturbing as Redskins, but
the Mets. We got the Mets.
Yes,
no,
we.
No objection.
Yes, we do, Judith.
And what also is very disturbing is what they do during those games when they do the chops.
That's what
the,
I mean with the tomahawks
the
and
yeah,
the yeah,
yeah.
That is and that's and that's it. It is disturbing.
Mm.
I love the fact that Sienna couldn't remember the name of the Redskins, and I couldn't remember the full names of Jeffrey Epstein and Harvey Weinstein. We reserve our brain cells
exactly.
for stuff that matters.
Bob said,
"This is something
go
that
ahead,
I,
Kristen.
I was just yeah. This is something I've been really grieving: is the indigenous culture and the foundation on which that culture is built on aligns." So much more certainly with my personal values. Mm-hmm. And so I've been grieving that the foundation of this country and how all of our, you know, the white supremacy culture of all of our structures is not based on that. I've been really grieving that lately for a long time because it's such a loss for all of us. Mm-hmm.
Sam writes to us and says, dear panel, I've studied all these men. Washington was opposed to slavery. It was a quandary for him, and he couldn't extricate himself from this issue in his time. Also, we got this from Jill, who says, I'm a 60-something African-American woman. I do agree with taking down all the monuments and statues of Confederate quote-unquote heroes. I do not agree with taking down Philip Schuyler's statue. He was a prominent family, had a prominent family in Albany and had major impacts in the American Revolution. Yes, he had slaves, but so did Washington and Jefferson. Andrew Jackson was responsible for the Trail of Tears Native Americans had to endure, and I could go on. No one is removing those monuments or statues. I would say yet, but yes, they're not removing them now. If we took down the statues of every hero, quote unquote, who had every hero who had slaves or wronged various minority peoples, we might as well take all monuments and statues down. I know many will disagree with me, but that's where I am on this. We go to Reed, who says, as all eyes are on statues and the celebration of slave owners and their profiteers being removed, it's about time, Reed says. What about a parallel conversation about monuments to great American black leaders and other minorities that celebrate social, cultural, and political contributions to our country and the world? Probably hard to do when we can't get a new $20 bill minted. That is, of course, over taking Jackson off of the $20 bill and putting Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill, which was a proposal that was squashed with this latest administration. We go to Nancy, who says, with a large number of Italian Americans, surely there must be any number of worthy heroes they could choose to replace Columbus. I can't believe Cuomo isn't showing some leadership in this direction. Let's see. We go to Jerry, who says most Confederate monuments were erected after 1900, and I believe many were funded by white supremacist organizations. This is why they need to go. It seems to me, says Barbara, that our country is based on the eradication of the Native American lifestyle and culture. How far do we go? How far do we go back to atone for our wrongs? Self-examination and reparations must follow. Also, Dre writes, I am of Italian-American heritage. I would be happy to see Columbus Day change to Indigenous Peoples Day and celebrate the people who inhabited this continent before Europeans arrived. It would also be good to have an Italian-American Pride Day or something similar to celebrate the Italian-Americans who contributed to this country, and without it being named for one particular, inevitably flawed person. R. Jeremy says, having read Ron Chernow's book on Washington and understanding his contribution to the constitutional basis of our nation, it is unthinkable not to have the Washington Monument. Curtis says, Southern Poverty Law Center has a graph that shows Confederate statues being constructed in response to reinforce white supremacy with spikes in response to black freedom up until the 1990s. Two more letters and then we'll take a break. Bob says, I'm 110% for removing all Confederate symbols from public spaces. Defeated traitors and their racist descendants deserve no such honors. But I'm having trouble applying the same standard to leaders whose crime was to be ahead, not to be ahead of their times in recognizing injustice and fighting it, or refusing to participate in profiting off of it. I think that leads to a never-ending moral purity campaign that will be terribly destructive to our great unfinished experiment. Anyone on that?
Or it's exactly what we need.
Or that. let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation, and we'll move on to some other subjects. We're getting a lot of letters on the statue issue, and we'll go back to those a little bit later on.
These are terrific letters.
They really are.
They really are.
Good group, don't we? Well, thank you for writing, and you can continue to do so. Panel at WAMC.org. We're going to take a break. Ray Graff with news. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. 7 minutes past 10 o'clock on this Friday, the 12th of June. And we welcome Judith Eng, Kristen Van Genhoven, and Sienna Freeman-Tolbert to the program. Alan is off today. We'll be back on Monday. And we thank you for your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Real quick, I asked the question about statues in Canada. Jennifer writes to us and says, around Toronto, one can find statues to Mohawk Valley loyalists like John Butler. Butler and his son Walter were considered terrorists by General Schuyler. They are considered founders in Ontario. So that perspective. That means you don't have to do your homework, Kristen. You're fine. You're good.
Oh,
takes up that time you're going to spend.
Because it's fascinating. Yeah, and she's right. I mean, it extends across the border. We all have to reckon with our past.
So as all of this is going on, let's bring the president into this conversation where,
Do we have to?
I know. And that's, you know, that has been a question for a long time on this program of when you do and when you don't. But Trump praises law enforcement response in Minneapolis, saying confronting bigotry will, quote, go very easily. He said this at an event in Dallas. President Trump praised the use of tear gas and other force to disperse Minneapolis protesters, calling it a, quote, beautiful scene, and describing the National Guard's actions like a knife cutting butter. I'll never forget, you saw this scene on that road. They were lined up. Man, they just walked straight. And yes, there was some tear gas and probably some other things, Trump said in opening remarks at a roundtable on policing and race. And the crowd dispersed and they went through by the end of that evening. And it was short evening. Everything was fine. Sienna.
Yes. Isn't it? Am I incorrect in saying that didn't two generals or one general speak out against what happened?
No, I think you were right the first time. Two actually spoke out. Yes.
Two spoke out about
two current that are in the administration, and then many, many outside or former members of the administration. But yes.
I mean, when you see what happened and the use of tear gas, I can't help but remember when the other people were picketing or protesting in front of the Michigan Assembly House against the COVID rules, you know, and the response to that. You can't help but think about the differences and the responses. It's just day and night that you feel.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was hearing an echo.
Oh, okay. I lost you for a second. Go ahead. You're all right now.
Oh, perfect. So you can't help but feel, to compare it to those protests and the response to those protests, where he says, support Michigan
liberate Michigan.
Liberate Michigan. Yes.
Kristen, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I always have like smile, which I'm sure so many listeners do. Everything to him is going to go very easily. You know, I mean, he says later in the article, like the work of confronting bigotry and prejudice, it'll go very quickly. It'll go very easily.
Certainly gone well over the last 300 years, hasn't it?
Yeah, it really has gone well. But, you know, when you think, it makes me wonder, right? I mean, the reason that this person is in office is these conservative, evangelical, predominantly white folks, you know, you look at Fox News, they're calling the protesters anarchists. So that base is so deep. It's the root that Sienna was talking about before. You know, are we going to be able to get to this root? Are people genuinely listening to him and saying, yeah, he's right, it's going to go very easily? And they are. Is there enough? You know, Judith seems very sure he's going to be a one-term president. I am not nearly as sure, even despite all of this craziness right now. I just think that the root is so deeply embedded that I'll be surprised. I want her to be right, believe me.
We all want to be, we want Judith to be right on everything, but yes. And she is usually, so that's great.
What?
Yeah.
Well,
say that again.
Well,
well, you know, it's going to take a lot of work. We shouldn't rest on our laurels. And I think the voting suppression in Georgia and Nevada and other places this week reminds us it's not just about getting big numbers out to vote, but also voter protection. I think the significance of this supposed roundtable that President Trump did yesterday in Dallas, to also talk about policing issues, the White House very purposefully excluded the top three law enforcement people in that county, the right. district attorney, the sheriff, the police commissioner, who all happened to be African American. They were not given a seat at the table. And I think, you know, the president handpicks people to do the dear leader routine. And there's not a check on these very irresponsible statements that he continues to make.
Oh, we lost Judith. Mid-sentence.
She always
too.
Sounds so calm when she's saying these things.
I know.
It's so impressive. You know, there's no check on, and I'm just like, the guy's moron.
Well, I think in the process, it seemed like it on the radio, but I think she crushed her microphone and now we can't hear her. So that we'll hopefully get her. We'll hopefully get her
back.
Yeah. Sienna, anything you want to add to that?
Not much. I just say I was hoping when Twitter started to post fact finding on him, he would stop tweeting, but that didn't happen.
Right. No, it didn't. But to Judith's point, I mean, you have this exclusion of people, and you know, we can only assume that this is done on purpose, and not just a quote unquote oversight. But it is disturbing. We did get a letter from a listener who said, amid this turbulent racial tension, the president led a positive, engaged roundtable discussion on policing and race relations. CNN, MSNBC, and New York Times, among other media outlets, didn't cover the event. The Trump-hating media refuses to cover news that is favorable to the president. Their hatred of 45 trumps the healing of the nation. I watched it. I will be honest to tell you, I can't tell you where I watched it. I watched it as it was happening, so I don't know which network ran it. The New York Times has covered it. The MSNBC has covered it. CNN has covered it. I don't know. Also, I would say it was many things. I don't know that it was positive. I mean, it was positive in the form of the police, but not as to other points of view, which, you know, is as Judith pointed out. Judith, are you with us again?
Yes. I'm
okay,
back.
Great.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. You know that obviously there's that Trump point of view. And meanwhile, there's everybody else who seems to be having this discussion that he doesn't want to be a part of. Judith, is there anything else you wanted to say that you were when you left us suddenly?
I have no idea how long I was talking to myself, but it was brilliant, and I can't replicate it. It's impossible.
I think we lost you at the point of the three people who were not the three African Americans who were not included in the panel, which was the important part. Yes,
you missed a lot.
Missed the really good part, didn't we? No. All right.
Yeah, we can move on. It's okay.
Okay. So do you think, is there a point where this, for the president, electorally, that he changes in any way or understands, and what does this mean for, the other changes that are being made throughout the country, that are meaningful and long overdue? Judith?
He's never going to change. I mean, anyone who's waiting for Trump to change is going to be waiting for the rest of their lives. He is doubling down. He is getting worse. He is feeling very cornered because his poll numbers are sliding. So I say this with all seriousness. I think we have to brace ourselves for some worse and more intense months ahead for us. I think June 1st, Monday, June 1st, is going to live in infamy with the Lafayette Square situation in D.C. when that park was violently cleared so Trump could do that very peculiar photo op holding up the Bible. Some of the military people say that they agreed with having the National Guard involved in coming to the streets of American cities because they were trying to prevent the president from bringing, full army presence.
Right. Yeah.
There were soldiers from Fort Drum and other forts at the ready, you know, in transport already. So the generals, remember, you know, Trump used to say my generals and how he loves his generals. They're trying to contain the very worst, I would say not particularly successfully, but it's going to get, you know, this is going to be a long, hot summer as the poll numbers go down. The intense action, not just rhetoric, but action by Trump is going to get worse.
Trump's campaign released an ad Wednesday focused on his self-proclaimed credentials as a law and order president while seeking to cast Joe Biden as overly supportive of those who have protested Floyd's death. Antifa destroys our communities, rioting, looting, yet Joe Biden kneels down, the narrator says, as footage of Biden kneeling in a church in Wilmington, Delaware is superimposed over images of violent protests. I did see that ad and I thought to myself, oh, is this an attack ad? Because I'm all for it. Like I'm in on this. Like, yeah, he did kneel down. Good.
Yeah. Hey Joe, can I just respond?
Of course.
Okay. I want to respond to Judith because I want to be more. I think we live in a capitalist society, and what you're seeing a lot of, even if they're just paying us lip service, is a lot of big companies supporting Black Lives Matter and equality. And I think eventually that might start to hit home with Trump. That is where our big hope is that these executives and these people in the boardrooms feel accountable now because they've made these statements about supporting equality, and that in and of itself will cause Trump to listen, who is a businessman as well, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know if it'll – that would be so lovely. I don't know – if he will listen, but the way I'm feeling about it is the hope that, you know, he's doing the Reagan playbook, right? Like step by step, this is what he's doing. That's why he did the Bible move. That's why he's got his rally on Juneteenth. You know, that's why he's the law and order president with that ad. I mean, he's just playing that rule book. And what I'm hoping with all my being is that that is no longer what guarantees a person to get elected, that it's not the evangelical pro-life, you know, that trajectory that got Reagan into office, that got Trump into office the first time, that playbook is no longer valid because these executives are being held accountable. The money that, you know, and I don't know, again, the root is so deep that, you know, has the pendulum shifted enough that being held accountable, that these folks with power and privilege who also have prejudice, are they going to do the right thing and speak up and stand firm or not? That's the question we're all going to be asked. Yeah. And 5 months is a long time. A lot's going to change in 5 months.
Yeah, they haven't so far. You know, the fossil fuel industry may cringe at some statements, but they love deregulation and they love not having serious climate change policies. And, you know, virtually every Senate Republican, with the exception of Mitt Romney and occasionally one other, is complicit with everything because they want to get their conservative judges through. And, you know, rich people are getting richer. So it's there is a vested economic interest in getting Trump reelected. And he's raising a lot of money.
You know, we've been all talking about our political fantasies this morning. But, you know, there's a Washington Post. There was a source in the Washington Post quoted of saying that the president is convinced that if you stoke these racial and cultural divisions, that is what's going to win him the election in 2020. Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
My hope and in what it seems to be over these last 2 weeks, and as you've all pointed out, as we have all pointed out, we're still 5 months, which is a long time. We're a long way to the election, but boy, you have to be encouraged by seeing so many young people involved in the process and so many people who are out taking to the streets. I'm so struck by my little village of Greenwich, New York, of seeing like 300 kids. And I'm basically saying anybody under 40 is a kid, by the way. But high school kids, college kids out there, and you think, man, if you can mobilize them, and if they realize because of the climate, because of both political and environmental, that this is important, that's my fantasy. I don't know if it can happen or what it needs to sustain that over the next 5 months.
Well, and I also have heard the point of view of people who, you know, were the hippies at Woodstock in the past, or talking about, yeah, it's easy for young people, and then they'll get a job and have a mortgage, and you know, their activist selves will go away. What's different this time is that the youth are across race, gender, economy,
right,
class, you know, all of that.
Right.
So that is incredibly different than in the past. And that's what I'm holding on to as hope.
You know, and it's just things about, we were talking about monuments earlier, but on Lark Street in Albany, they painted the mural on the street, much like they did in Washington, D.C. by the White House, of Black Lives Matter. And has anyone seen it? Have you been down there to see it yet? It's really striking. And I was down there early this morning taking a walk and just talking to people about it and of all races and backgrounds, and people going down to see it. And it's just a fascinating thing, and something that to me just seems so easy. Like, you paint that on the street, and they've closed the street. I think they've closed the street until Sunday. So people can go down and see it, and it's really powerful. I think it's powerful. It's really meaningful because, again, it's something that there were a lot of people out. Even this morning at 7:30 this morning, people were out. They were walking. They were young people, and they were looking at it and talking, which is, I think, so important. Stan, I wanted to ask you about a quote from Katrina Pearson, a senior advisor to the Trump campaign, who said, as the party of Lincoln, Republicans are rightly proud of what Juneteenth represents and of President Trump's excellent record of achievement for Black Americans.
Katrina.
Katrina.
When I found out that he was doing it in Tulsa on Juneteenth, I just felt like this was orchestrated by Stephen Miller. That's exactly what I thought about. I was like, someone planned this, because I can't imagine he's going to say anything uplifting or positive about that day.
Well, right. I mean, if you're quoted, if the statement is true, what was quoted in the Post, that you, if you stoke these, if these racial and cultural divisions, and you stoke that, this would be the quote unquote perfect place to do it,
right,
and way to do it. I think, you know, you hope in the bottom of your heart of like, oh, they just didn't look at the calendar enough.
No.
But we now realize, of course, that isn't the case. And while Stephen Miller hasn't specifically been outed in this particular case yet, and I don't believe, and I don't disagree with you, Sienna, what has happened is, as many people have said, that yes, this was long thought out, that this would be the return, and when it should happen and where it should happen.
Yeah. Associated Press had reporting that it was done on purpose.
Remember that, just, you know, what he said about the Confederate, taking down the Confederate names on the fort. And now to say to us, you're going to celebrate Juneteenth, it just doesn't ring as true.
No, not at all. Not at all. Judith, I'm sorry, on the Associated Press was saying what?
Yeah, AP got comment from the White House yesterday that they were aware of the date, and they decided they'd have a 24-hour bad news cycle and move on from it. So yeah. Let's make sure it's not just 24 hours. I think there's going to be a lot of good public education on the significance of Juneteenth. And I think there's going to be a fair amount of activism around that in that swing state, Oklahoma. You know, he really needs to go there.
And, you know, I've heard of a great number of counter protests that are expected on that to the president. And I'm interested, Sienna, of what you make of we're in what the 17th night now of protests. That continue all across the country, and many very, very large protests expected this weekend. What do you make of that action, which speaks again to what seems to be happening to so many parts of our country?
I can tell you, I'm very encouraged by it. It was I had a conversation with my 8-year-old son, and I was explaining to him about George Floyd and everything, but I was also able to show him the different protests that were happening every day. And he gets to say, you know, mommy, why are they out there? And they're standing for, you know, Black Lives Matter. They're against police brutality. It is beautiful to see people protesting and to continue to do so and to see that they haven't dropped the cause, so to speak. So it is a beautiful thing.
Unfortunately, we only have about a minute before our break. But, I mean, how do you, as a mother, explain the killing of George Floyd to an 8-year-old son? I can't imagine that.
I was talking to my husband about it because we're trying to decide whether or not to have this discussion with him because he's going to live it.
Right.
Right? But what we do is, we took him to the African American Museum in D.C. just for a quick air, and he saw slavery. And I remember him saying, "Mommy, why are the peach people mad at the brown people?"
Oh.
And I said, "You know, it's just they made bad decisions." And as you go up the floor in the African American Museum, you start to see all these successes despite the slavery that you saw on the first two floors. And that's what I teach him. I said, "This is what happened, but look at these protests." So despite what police brutality, despite discrimination, despite the way people may look at you and judge you, you're going to be great.
Mm.
And that makes you greater.
We're going to hold there, and we'll talk more when we come back. We have a wonderful panel this morning, Judith Eng, Kristen Van Genhoven, and Sienna Freeman-Tolbert. We will continue our conversation. We do welcome your letters. We'll still take those. We have time for more. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We will be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel this morning. We have Judith Eng, Kristen Van Genhoven, and Sienna Freeman-Tolbert. Alan is away today. We'll be back on Monday's broadcast. I want to get to another topic or two and then read some letters. In our last go-around here, we have about 15 minutes together left. So let's go to a poll that was taken, and this is interesting. We you know, we sort of dance around polls sometimes of what we think of them as we discuss them on this program. But I think this one is interesting, brought to my attention by Judith Enk, that it was a poll taken about what voters think the president's biggest weakness is. One of the widest gaps in how voters perceive the presidential candidates is on environmental policy, even as the nation reckons with a deadly pandemic and an eruption of protests over racial injustice. Recent polls reveal broad mistrust of President Trump's handling of environmental issues, suggesting that Joe Biden, the presumptive Democratic nominee, has a large advantage on those issues less than 5 months before the election. The gulf between Trump and Biden on the environment is larger than their perceived differences to voters over race relations, the economy, and health care, according to recent polling. Those issues are nevertheless expected to be central themes of the November election. Okay, Judith Enk, what do you make of that? Not a big surprise, I assume, from your perspective.
I'm not surprised, but I am encouraged. Environment typically does not show up in, you know, the top three issues that people vote on. But I think things are changing because of climate change. And the fact that there's been this drumbeat, you know, since Trump took office, he has repealed or delayed 100 major environmental regulations, everything from air pollution to drinking water. Oil and gas drilling is happening at unprecedented rates on public lands, pesticide exposure. All of these, by the way, have serious environmental justice implications because so many polluting facilities are typically sited in communities of color or low-income communities. So voters, you know, even if you're just following the headlines, voters know that. So I'm glad that this is showing up in how people are making electoral decisions. And I might add that, you know, sometimes the states are filling the gap. Sometimes they're not. An important local issue that's been in the news is the Norlite hazardous waste incinerator in Cohoes, located right next to a public housing complex. And there, the U.S. Department of Defense, knowing that environmental protection was not a priority for the Trump administration, signed a 5-year contract to burn toxic firefighting foam containing PFAS chemicals in a city, in the city of Cohoes. Thankfully, the New York State Legislature unanimously passed a bill just this week to prohibit that practice. And we are awaiting word from Governor Cuomo whether he's going to sign or veto that bill. And passing that bill was necessary because the federal government is not only passive on environmental protection, but aggressively anti-environmental, which means, you know, more exposure to contaminants, which means compromised health, degraded environment, something that will take decades for us to recover from. So I think this is encouraging news, and people should make environment one of the top issues they look at when they choose a candidate.
Thomas writes a letter and says, I'm all for the outrage about systemic racism. Let's continue to make movements in the direction of equality, reparations, and social healing. But when will there be a similar outrage about the degradation of the environment? Other countries have made large changes towards sustainability, but America lags behind. As the planet continues to heat up, it doesn't give a damn about your skin color. I read that, and we talk about the polling that is taking place. Is it and I'm encouraged that you're encouraged. But often it gets these environmental issues often seem to get lost. I mean, I don't remember a recent campaign, despite the grave concerns that so many have had about the climate, where it was the major issue of the campaign.
Well, you're right. A lot of this will depend on how Joe Biden embraces, you know, the climate change issue. Does he articulate a vision that really, I love Kristen repeatedly talking about getting to the root and, you know, the roots of the fossil fuel industry are deep. And so I think Biden has some responsibility to elevate the issue, but so do all of us. And there, you know, there is such a close connection between racism and environmental damage. It used to be called environmental racism. There's a just amazing book by Dr. Bob Bullard published 30 years ago about environmental racism. And we certainly live this in the Capital District. The answer is garbage incinerator in Arbor Hill, which took years to get shut down. The Lafarge cement plant across the street from a school in Ravenna. These polluting facilities are almost always in low-income communities or communities of color. And so kids with asthma, high cancer rates, developmental disabilities from lead poisoning, this is all connected. And so I think this grassroots international movement to address white supremacy will also address why is it that the Norlite incinerator is in Cohoes and not Loudonville? Not that I would wish this on Loudonville, but there's a pattern here and people pay for it with their health.
Bob asks the question, says, Judith, which came first, the public housing project or the Norlite plant? I suspect, but don't know, that the plant was there first.
Yes. And there's, you know, and it's not just Cohoes and Norlite, it's the south end of Albany with all of the air pollution from the port and the storage of the Bakken crude trains. You know, public housing is not usually, you know, sited along Washington Park or nicer, leafy suburban neighborhoods.
Let's get to a couple of letters before we have to go this morning and get ready for the weekend. Barbara says, in order to go to the Tulsa Race Riot MAGA rally, one has to sign a disclaimer saying you will not sue the Trump election campaign if you get COVID. Will those folks, which is true, will those folks who have to work at the rally, vendors, cleaners, and the like, also have to sign a disclaimer? Thank you for this wonderful, informative program. Yeah, that is when they released the ticketing yesterday, that is one of the things you have to sign and say you won't sue them if you get COVID as a result of breaking pretty much every rule that initially the administration set up as the guidelines for the task force. Remember that?
Yeah, Joe, if I can circle back too, I just had a couple of thoughts. One is I just want to mention Sienna is the one who brought up the route, and I just ran with it this morning, but that idea first came early in the program from Sienna, so just want to affirm that. And then also this environmental issue, you know, all these young folks that are out protesting, environment is a huge, you know, my 18-year-old niece is, you know, she just thinks, you know, what's the world going to be? So the environment is a real top of mind issue. So if Biden and the Democrats are able to make it and strengthen that climate platform, they may pick up some of those young voters, which, you know, could make a really big difference in this upcoming election.
Sienna?
And Judith, I agree with you. I think I remember during 2019 when AOC brought out the Green New Deal. Mm-hmm. And there started to be this good discussion on TV and in the media about climate. But I think it is a big deal.
We got a letter from Jeff, who says, one of your panelists made a very key point forgotten by myself and perhaps everyone when unruly protesters who wanted to open up Michigan stormed their capital with guns and spit or yelled in the police faces without wearing masks. There was encouragement, not outcry, from the White House and fellow conservatives. There was no call for law and order or putting down the unruly protesters. Barbara says, will Trump really be the Republican candidate for president? Speaking of self-examination, how can the Republican Party in any good conscience allow him to be the nominee? Well, I think we've passed that point. We're at the point of no return, right?
That ship has sailed.
Seems it. There would have to be a lot of action very quickly, I think, for that to change. Pam takes us to task, although I think gently. Stop using the rewriting history phrase. We're not rewriting history. We're editing history. We're editing what has already been written to be more accurate and true. With the monuments that we leave, put a plaque that explains the whole situation. Openness and the whole truth or context is the goal. Also from this listener who says, in 1950, I moved from the north to Greenville to, excuse me, suddenly I sounded like I was from the south. In 1950, I moved from the north to Greenville, South Carolina. As a young child, the Klan was still burning crosses in the main city park. A lynching had occurred in 1948 and was widely publicized in a series of Rebecca West New Yorker articles. Publicity resulted in South Carolina bringing its first lynching prosecution, but of course, all 25 defendants were acquitted. I'm thrilled at seeing the Confederate memorials coming down. I can't believe it has taken this long, but better late than never. Sienna?
I agree. Better late than never.
You know, many of us have lived through this history. I say this jokingly, but, you know, I'm only 52. But I remember as a kid driving into North Carolina where there was a sign that said, "Welcome to North Carolina, home of the Ku Klux Klan."
Oh,
I mean,
wow.
That's in my lifetime. And that was after the Civil Rights Movement.
And isn't it sad that the writer writes, of course, they were acquitted. You know, it's what we expect.
Yes.
It's so sad that that's our truth. You know, that's got to change.
Well, and I think this is the first time in this program. I can't believe that I waited till the last 2 minutes to have you put on your lawyer hat, Sienna. But as far as, you know, even the police officers in Minneapolis, I mean, the great concern over these charges is that they won't stick.
Exactly. I mean, they have a higher standard. The law is made to protect them, and it's just unfortunate. That they continue to be immunized from these prosecutions. Because obviously, most professions, if something goes wrong, the profession works within themselves to fix it. But we know that that's not working in the police community. And so we need to have independent prosecution. And we need to have laws that address this issue.
We are out of time. I want to thank everybody. We had an amazing discussion today, and I thank everyone. Judith Enk, Krishna Van Genhoven, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, thank you so much. Sienna, you did, man, what a great debut. Thank
Woo-hoo!
You so much. We do hope you will return. Kristen
yes.
and Judith, certainly thank you so
yes.
much as always.
Let's keep the all women band together. This is a good group.
Female,
you know, creative. And when we can, we'll take it on the road. I promise it'll be great.
Yes.
Thank you all. Have a beautiful
and Jen
weekend.
Smith and we'll be unbeatable.
Yes. Excellent
We'll
Kristen on drums, right? Last time you called the drums.
That's right.
All right. We'll stop, Joe. We'll let you end the show.
That's
We've
all right.
Taken over now.
We'll be right back after this.